Okay, this discussion is taking place at an unplanned, very topical time. It takes place under the auspices of the profession, but particularly the immediate stimulus has been something within the profession called the Global Financial Crisis Group, which is a group of people with an interest in some cases in the crisis and in some cases in what might be done about the crisis. And that was the original stimulus for this discussion. It's very timely for many reasons, one of which is that, unless you know better, earlier today something called CORREPER, the Committee of Permanent Representatives of the European Union Nations in Brussels, should have signalled its assent to the draft Solvency II directive. The directive has been a bit of a movement feast in recent days, but I understand that something should have been approved during today. As it happens, I was in Frankfurt last Thursday meeting Thomas Steffen, the head of something called CEOPS, the Committee of European Insurance Supervisors. And we were looking forward to the prospect of Solvency II being approved. And the conversation somehow came round to what would we do differently if we had the chance to come at Solvency II again. There is absolutely no possibility now of changing the directive. The negotiations have been far too painful. And interestingly, the first thing Thomas volunteered was, I don't think I'd go for 99.5% VAR concept. So that's background to our discussion. He, like myself, was much less clear as to what might be put in its place. And I'm sure that's something we'll come back to discuss. Also among those who are no longer, if they ever were, fans of VAR, is Lord Turner. Andrew will talk about this some more, but we all have seen the publication last week of the Turner Review with criticism not so much of sophisticated mathematics as of reliance on sophisticated mathematics. One of the issues which Lord Turner discussed, I had the opportunity to go along and hear him at Cass Business School on the day he published his review, but one of the issues he tried to address is objectively, how much capital is enough for a financial institution, in particular a bank? And tried to use Modigliani and Miller and so on to come at this, but he failed. As part of that, he recounted the history of the Basel development, and particularly the move from Basel I to Basel II. And Basel II was very much calibrated such that the total amount of capital in the banking industry globally would not be changed to any significant degree. There was no objective underlying concept. It was very much calculated to preserving the amount of capital within the industry. And Solvency II, in effect, has followed a similar process in terms of the development of at least the standard Solvency II formula. All the quantitative studies we've seen get a big tick when, on average, the level of capital in the industry is unchanged. So that poses a question which actuaries might feel able to address, which is there any objective measure of how much capital is needed by the banking industry, the insurance industry? So we have VAR as an underlying concept within Solvency II. I think it has probably been sufficiently diluted that I'm not sure it's fair to say that the standard formula is actually calibrated to 99.5% VAR in any objective way anymore. But one final change which is worth mentioning as background to the discussion is that the Canadian supervisor has been rethinking their approach to capital requirements, specifically in the context of segregated fund business with guarantees, which has some analogies with, say, variable annuities. And the concept which they've introduced, or haven't introduced yet, but seem to have settled on, is a concept of what we will hear about, which is tailvar, or conditional tail expectation, but one where the confidence level varies. It decreases from a very high initial level for liabilities which have to be met, say, within the next year, to a much lower confidence level to liabilities which have to be met at some point 20, 25, 30 years in the future. To the best of my knowledge, that's unique thinking, but it just shows the many possibilities which can exist for defining capital requirements. It's a pleasure to have to discuss the background to some of these issues. Three really first-class speakers with whom I feel I've lived through the financial crisis for much of the last 18 months as we've sought to digest in a risk-free rate working party the many gyrations of markets and interest rates during that time. You will hear later from Colin Wilson, who tells me that he has recently moved from the private sector to the public sector. I think post-crisis those boundaries are not so firm as they once were, but Colin will be speaking later, as will Malcolm Kemp, another stalwart of our working party. Malcolm is something of a guru on the issues which we're going to be discussing, and some of us have had the privilege of seeing extracts from a book which he is going to be publishing later this year called Market Consistency, and which I'm sure will be a bestseller for actuaries. There's been lots of good raw material in recent times. But first of all, a man who needs no introduction whatsoever. Everyone knows Andrew Smith. Over to you, Andrew.
Thanks, Seamus. It falls to me to talk to you about what value at risk is. I'm not going to tell you whether it's good or bad or indifferent. I'm just going to describe how I think it is. So what is value at risk? We usually think about value at risk in terms of a probability definition. But actually, as practiced in industry, there's more components to it than that. So when you hear people saying value at risk has failed, they're not necessarily talking about the failure of the probability distribution. So what are the bits? Well, there's a definition. There's a process of calibrating models based on historic data. There's a process of feeding statistics about markets through models of financial institutions. And then there's a process of backtesting. And all of these things go together. For example, in the Basel Accord, in the way that value at risk is used. So when you hear criticisms of value at risk, it's usually one of these four bits that are being criticised. So here's the probability definition, which I think is probably familiar to all of you. If you wanted to measure a 5% value at risk, you would look at the current net assets of a business, you'd look at the distribution of possible net assets at its future time horizon, assuming you could estimate that. You'd look at the line that separated the worst 5% of outcomes from the worst 95% of outcomes, and the distance between that and where you are now is the definition of value at risk. And to specify that, you need to say what your time horizon is and also what percentile you're looking at. And many insurers use or claim to use 0.5th percentile of the one-year time horizon, but I didn't draw it on this chart because if you draw it, it just looks silly. The percentile is so far off from the left-hand tail that you can barely see anything to the left of it. So I drew something more visually appealing. So that's the definition. What about historic calibration? Well, the idea is that if you want to estimate that distribution in the future, well, you can't look into the future very easily. What you can do is look how variable things have been in the past. And I've chosen here one example of many I could have picked where that plainly stops working at a critical point halfway along the chart. And if you had calibrated to this based on, it's actually a spread on overnight index swaps, but it almost doesn't matter what that series is. It's one of the many thousands of series that feed mechanically into value at risk calculations. And if you had tried to anticipate somewhere around the middle of 2007 how that was going to emerge, more or less however you had calibrated that past data, you probably would not have ended up with anything like what looks on the right-hand side. So that doesn't mean to say that past data is a completely stupid thing to do, because what else is the alternative? You could have asked a sample of experts and they probably wouldn't have foreseen it either. So I'm not trying to say this is universally a terrible approach, but at least let's not try to make too many adventurous claims for how great an approach this is. So having calibrated to historic data, and I'm sorry for the typo in your handouts, it is an example, not an ex-maple. You then have to aggregate it, and the process of aggregation goes a little bit like this. You start by looking at a financial firm's exposure to a whole load of drivers. So one of those might be a duration measure or a delta to equity markets. And there's different degrees of sophistication. Sometimes you might measure large and small moves. Sometimes you only look at small ones. Sometimes you look at what you can measure. And then you've got historically estimated volatilities, historic correlations. You put them all together, and out comes, by some sort of Taylor series expansion, an estimate of how your future net assets might vary as a function of these historic variables, put in the correlations, and you get theoretically a distribution. It's often said that value at risk assumes normal distributions. In fact, the most widely used software, the risk metrics model, uses t-distributions, which is not a stupid place to start. It's not so obviously refuted by the data as normal distributions. So there's an aggregation approach that involves having a model of the business as well as having a model of markets. And then the last approach, last part of this, which is sometimes overlooked, is backtesting. So how does backtesting work? Well, this is how it would work if you were doing a 15-day value at risk with 5% value at risk, 5%, 5 percentile. You would start looking at some long time ago, maybe 5 years ago. You'd say, knowing what I knew 5 years ago, what would I have calculated as my 15-day value at risk? And then you look at 5 years minus 15 days ago, so 4 years and a bit, and you see whether what actually happened to your net assets was below or above your claimed fifth percentile. And what you might hope is that you get an exception about one time in 20. So if you get an exception more often than one in 20, then you haven't calibrated a value at risk. You'd calibrate at 5%, you maybe use higher than 5%. And if you get exceptions less often, then that also suggests a miscalibration of your percentiles. And banks report these exception frequencies, and usually actually they're quite a bit below the claimed percentile. In other words, there's some prudence in the way they're put together. So however much you might criticise lots of these elements of value at risk, to my knowledge, nobody has actually criticised and said it's stupid to do backtesting. So maybe that's the one bit we're going to be allowed to keep. I would mention it's actually quite difficult to do backtesting of some of the other measures. So if you're measuring over 1 year, it's not that obvious how to do backtesting. If you look back 10 years, you've got 10 observations and you're testing whether the exception frequency was 1 in 20. That's a bit of a tough call. If you're doing runoff, it's even harder to do backtesting for obvious reasons. So those are the bits. Now, lots of people have said lots of things about value at risk. Here is what Turner said. Turner says that this technique was accepted as standard across the industry. I think that's true. Adopted by regulators as well. That's also true. There are fundamental questions about the validity of VAR. When you look through the rest of the reports, it seems to me that what Turner has to offer instead, based on gross assets, is not necessarily any better than VAR. But what he can say is that VAR is worse than we thought VAR was, even if it's not worse than anything else. He also criticises short periods of observation. That's interesting. If you pick up the Basel Accord, that says you should calibrate to at least 100 days of data, which to people in this room might not seem very long. I was standing on this platform explaining not that long ago why we'd calibrated some equity models to nearly 40 years of data, and some people, you can probably guess who, said 100 years of data would have been better. And so there's debates. And if you look at the risk metrics technical documentation, they say 100 days is much too long. They say 100, and essentially the reason why they say it's much too long is it doesn't respond quickly enough. So they actually suggest about a 10-day period. So if you'd use a 10-day period on this chart, you might have been wrong for 10 days, but at least 10 days into that volatility, you would have picked up something was going awry. So it's not a completely daft argument. You can see where they're coming from. So Turner thinks that not only was 100 inadequate, it should have been longer, whereas risk metrics think it should have been shorter. Turner also thinks it introduced dangerous pro-cyclicality But that's not necessarily a statistical criticism. So it's entirely conceivable that you could have a measure which correctly calculated a certain percentile, and it still introduced procyclicality. Okay, so it's not necessarily a problem in execution. That could have been a problem in setting a standard that then has difficult effects afterwards. He also complains about the complexity of the maths, and I have to say I'm not at all sympathetic to that. It just seems to me that if top management of boards can't understand value at risk, they have no chance at all of understanding any of the alternative competing concepts which people think are better. And so the solution really is to change the board rather than the risk measure, in my opinion. On that note, I'll hand on to Colin.
Right. Thank you, Andrew, for that brief introduction. I must say, picking up on one of your comments, that VAR is worse than we thought it was, as sort of a conclusion from the Turner Review. What I'm going to have to say, in some ways, we'll challenge that. I think the answer is it depends what you use it for, and to my mind, VAR is certainly useful for many risk management purposes. But one thing that I would argue it is not useful for is calculating a 99.5th percentile of a one-year distribution of outcomes. And the reason I'm challenging that it's saying it's worse than we thought it was is really that I think many people never thought it was any good for this purpose. And certainly there were people who were making these comments. And this quote I'm giving here, it's bad form, I'm afraid, because I'm quoting myself from a session in this room about 5 years ago. And this was actually in response to a paper that Andrew had written. And I wasn't criticising the paper in the slightest on the realistic valuation of life insurance. But what I said then was that requiring insurers to hold sufficient assets to meet a theoretical buyout test in normal times, as well as holding risk-based capital to cover the likelihood of significant increases in costs during conditions of financial distress, seems entirely sensible. But it is by no means clear that capital should be required to meet buyout costs in distressed situations where any buyout market might be suffering extreme dislocation. And to my mind, that's exactly what a short-term VAR-type measure is trying to do. It's trying to estimate what the buyout cost, what the cost of closing out the business, if you like, would be at the end of the year. And in extreme situations, arguably, such as those we're experiencing at the moment, that's just not possible to do. It becomes not just a theoretical question, but one to which there is no possible answer. And my point is really that I think it was clear that was the situation when this was proposed as a standard, and that there were better alternatives that could be used. However, I think we probably all know what did happen, that when the regulations were published with regard to how to do an individual capital assessment, the regulations didn't prescribe doing a 99.5th percentile one-year VAR, but they did very much push people in that direction and make it the easier choice. And so not surprisingly, that's what most people ended up doing. But I have given a few quotes from the regulations themselves here, because I think there was still quite a lot of uncertainty what it all meant at the end of the day. And I'm thinking here in particular about the context of holding matching credit assets against annuity-style business. But what the quotes from the regulations said, the risk associated with these assets, or the assets backing liabilities, should be considered over the full term for which the firm expects to carry the liabilities. This was alongside the bits pushing people to say that anything you do must be comparable with a 99.5th percentile one-year VAR. So that was the standard which was being set up, but nonetheless there were comments like this about the risk of the assets over the full term. But then conversely, the valuation of liabilities should be consistent with the valuation of assets to the extent the market price, presumably of the assets, includes an implicit allowance for risk. This should be included within the valuation of liabilities. So there's no clear guidance here about how you estimate the allowance for risk in the price of an asset and what that means for liabilities, but nonetheless, you've clearly got to, if you like, use some kind of risk adjustment. And then again, For risks that are not observable over a short period, the confidence level may be measured with reference to the probability distribution for the emergence of that risk over the lifetime of the liabilities. So the example that then is given is that of longevity risk for annuity business, where quite clearly the risk does emerge over a long period, and so specifying a one-year VAR isn't really going to give you anything very helpful. So there's a recognition that that applies in that case, and I suppose my comments around the annuity business and the uncertainty here really come down to the question of what best describes credit risk in the context of annuity business. Is this credit risk, default risk, that that materialises over a long period, or is it simply the short-term market value risk that should be taken into account? And I do think that has been something which certainly since over the period since the ICA regime came in, lots of questions have been asked. Okay, so that's the background. Then I just want to give sort of a very brief overview of some of the choices that have to be made in terms of coming up with an economic capital measure. I accept what Seamus has said around Solvency II, that probably we're stuck with something calling itself a 99.5% one-year VAR. But I really, in that sense, this maybe isn't such a timely discussion because I still think that we should be debating that, because I don't think we have the answer as to what the best method would be. But the basic choices you have to make, obviously, over the time horizon over which you want to try and measure a risk, should it be over the runoff of the business, or should it be a value at risk type measure? And obviously, 1 year VAR is the typical example which we use in the insurance industry. You can also think of that as potentially as a cash flow basis versus a balance sheet basis for doing a calculation. If you're doing a balance sheet basis, then at the end of the year, you have to value the balance sheet of the business in order to work out what the potential variation is that has been. If you're doing a runoff calculation, then you're actually looking much more at the cash flows that materialise over the course of that. So to me, the question, as the choice between these, boils down to actually what is it that you want capital for? Should insurers be holding capital for funding risk over the long term, or is it all around the short-term risk transfer? And I'm going to come back to that later as a question. I think the former, so the runoff, is widely applicable, and I would say it's a natural approach for actors to think about. It's maybe the way that we've always thought about things over the long term. Whereas a VAR-type calculation is more of a hypothetical question, because the risk transfer, as I've said before, it may not actually be feasible to transfer the risk after the one-year period is over. So why try and ask the question about what it would cost to do that? A point that I think is quite key here, though, is that whichever approach you adopt, you do need to make some critical modelling assumptions in either case. So it isn't the case, to my mind, that the underlying data and assumptions are easier if you adopt one solution or the other. They're simply different. For example, if we're looking at a runoff calculation for something like with profits business, let's say, in particular, then we certainly need to think about, over the long term, what do we think about equity mean reversion and how that affects the risks over the long term. We could say the same about credit risk. Conversely, if we're looking over a shorter term and doing a market consistent valuation at the end of that period, there are a lot of questions about how do we take into account short-term market dislocations. So there are assumptions that need to be made in either calculation. Then we come to the question about what confidence level should we choose for to setting our capital. As we heard, 99.5th percentile is the one that we tend to use for VAR in the insurance industry. Of a runoff calculation, it's probably a lower number designed to be something that's equivalent to, roughly speaking, a 0.5% chance of insolvency each year, and that often comes out to be something like a 95% probability over the runoff. It's interesting to note that when people were doing these calculations a few years ago, there were insurers, indeed, as well as banks, publishing figures claiming to be calculating the economic capital at a 99.97% level, so at a much higher probability even than 99.5th percentile. I don't think there's any way you can do that without assuming something like a normal distribution or certainly assuming a distribution, and most people did assume normal for those type of calculations. But even then, the question arises, is that, if you're using a distribution like that, are you accepting that the percentile you're choosing is simply that relates to that distribution, or are you considering separately from that there might be some extreme scenarios that take place and allowing for those in the calculation? The final question is around the actual statistical measure, around potentially taking a percentile of a distribution or a conditional tail expectation, and that's something that Malcolm's going to be talking about in a minute. So having made the choice about which one of these, then we've got some questions, I guess, around the actual method that we might use to do the calculation. I'm not going to talk about this much, but clearly, in historically, and indeed in some calculations today, one just uses a formula and says, we'll take a risk-based capital approach that says apply a parameter to multiply by some risk measure like premiums or something like that, and so we come up with capital from that. But in general, that's no longer considered adequate, but the sort of modelling that we're talking about is probably a better way to get a good handle on risks. Often, people talk about a one-year calculation, but actually do instantaneous stress tests, look at things over a very short time period, but apply a stress that is calibrated as though that's what you expect might happen over 1 year. If you're doing those sorts of stress tests, then the real issue comes down to obviously how to choose the level of those stress tests, but also how to combine them. And Andrew talked a bit about that. In particular, you've got to think about the percentile of the distribution, of the combined distribution that you would get if you're combining individual stress tests, and potentially adjust for various interactions between the different risk factors, which mean that there are so-called non-linearities in the calculation. Alternatively, you could do Monte Carlo simulation. You obviously need a sophisticated model to be able to do this, but you can do this type of calculation over both a one-year period or over the runoff, where you need a model that does project coherently possible outcomes for the assets and liabilities of the business, and you probably need to capture future management actions in those calculations and so on. Generally speaking, that allows the interactions between the risk factors to be observed directly, assuming that the underlying stochastic model obviously captures those interactions. But there are computational complexities generally in doing this, so the so-called nested stochastic problem typically will arise in doing this type of calculation. So those are the methods and some of the the issues that one has to think about in making a choice between them. I guess the question about how to decide between them, to my mind, this really comes down to what is it we're actually trying to achieve? What is the objective in setting an economic capital measure in the first place? So, for example, it might be that one of the objectives is, and clearly is, to protect the policyholders of an insurance company. Or, in fact, it might be the compensation scheme that lies behind it rather than the policyholders directly, but nonetheless you are trying to protect the solvency of the company. This is where I come back to the question I asked earlier, though. The question is, what is planned? What are you going to do if the capital requirements are breached? Are you going to put the company into runoff, or are you going to try and sell it, transfer its business to another insurance company at a market price that exists then, and then continue to run that as an ongoing business, if you like? And that might indeed impact on whether you think the runoff approach or the value at risk approach is a more appropriate way to set capital requirements, depending on what you're going to do should it fail. And I think Malcolm again will say a bit more about possibilities around thinking about what happens in failure later on. Another objective, fairly obviously, is that you want to contribute to financial stability. And I think this is what's behind a lot of the comments which are in the Turner Review around pro-cyclicality. And it would be good if the method you had, whilst not compromising the other objectives, does contribute to enhancing stability rather than the opposite. Again, I might repeat the point I made earlier about if it's not news that the method that was come up with, the value at risk approach, was going to increase pro-cyclicality rather than reduce it, there were plenty of people, including, in fact, central bankers, writing papers explaining that this was a method, this was a consequence of what was going to be in Basel II. But again, that didn't actually impact on and what happened at the end of the day. You obviously want to encourage appropriate risk management behaviours in the way that you set economic capital requirements. And here, and this is actually quite important, I think, in terms of thinking about a possible solution. My point is that one wants to treat different risks comparably, in order to make sure that you're not just encouraging people to take one sort of risk rather than another sort of risk. This point was made quite forcibly by the Extreme Value Working Party that reported a sessional meeting recently, that it's no good just sort of arbitrarily setting standards for different risks and saying, well, those are the stresses we're going to apply, because you can be encouraging the wrong behaviours then. But another very important point that comes out of this is the question about does the method sufficiently distinguish between idiosyncratic risks for individual businesses and systemic risks? If you've got a calculation where each company is doing something independently and assuming that they can always offload the assets at the end of the year if they need to, but everybody else is making that same assumption, then clearly that's not going to work, and what you're doing is creating systemic risk. So probably when you're doing a capital calculation, you need to be distinguishing between idiosyncratic risks, where perhaps a fairly simple approach is going to work, and systemic risks, where you get the sort of feedback effects that we've effectively been seeing recently, where it may well not work. And a final objective is around ensuring some comparability between firms, that you want to set something which means that there's a level playing field between companies in terms of the amount of capital they hold. And this is where the question about under Solvency II between a standard model and internal models comes up, which I will again come back to again in a minute. So just moving on to think about a few issues now that that might affect our choices and how they impact on meeting those objectives. This slide, I've just talked about a number of issues with market consistent valuation, largely because I see this as being the driver of what goes wrong in the insurance world with the VAR approach, where generally speaking, we clearly need to do a balance sheet valuation at the end of the year, as I said, and generally speaking, that's done using a realistic balance sheet approach or a market consistent valuation. But I think it's worth remembering exactly what a market consistent value actually is in this context. It is the value, it's the expected cost of a marginal transaction. It doesn't really answer the question, as I posed earlier, what would be the price if we transferred the whole of a business to another business. So market consistent values are clearly very useful in plenty of contexts. For example, if you're thinking about new business pricing, if you're thinking about your risk management, and you're thinking about whether or not to transfer various risks, the marginal price of one of these transactions is very important in those contexts. But as I said before, what happens in the 1 in 200 year event? What happens if liquidity dries up, which it clearly will do in those situations? And if that's the case, that actually we can't calculate a market consistent price in those circumstances, then do we actually end up with a conclusion that all the market risks are actually non-hedgeable in the language of Solvency II? The framework there distinguishes between risks which are hedgeable in the market, where you can observe a market price, and where that price is a sufficiently deep and liquid market that you can always observe that market price, essentially. And my point is it actually the case that there aren't any market risks where there is sufficient liquidity for that to be the case? There are also calibration issues to think about, and these are ones which, again, Andrew referred to, the problem with if the future is simply, or the present is simply so different from what we've had in the past, is there any way one can actually calibrate such a model and generally say this is going to be a 99.5th percentile of the future distribution? Again, as I said before, this is an issue whether or not we're thinking about the value at risk approach or the runoff approach. It's just that potentially there are different calibration issues in those cases. And I would argue that in either case, and again, this was a message that came out strongly from the working paper I referred to of the Extreme Value Working Party, that any calibration where you're looking to go into something like a 99.5th percentile of a distribution, you have to make some very strong assumptions about how you believe the world works. You have to have some prior beliefs, And indeed, you have to, part of those prior beliefs must be some kind of view about how the future will relate to the past. And I would argue that the 99.5th percentile is simply too extreme to be able to estimate with any kind of confidence or uncertainty with any kind of comparability between different estimates as to what that percentile would be. Somebody used the phrase in the discussion of that Working Party paper, your guess is as good as mine. I think that may be a bit extreme, but nonetheless, it's clear there simply isn't the data to enable a consistent view to be deduced. And a further question that I still don't think has ever been answered satisfactorily is, are we aiming to find a percentile of a distribution which is conditional on current market conditions? It's from where we are, what we think is the percentile of a distribution now, and therefore it will be different this year from next year because current market conditions are different. Or is it actually an unconditional number we're looking for if we have the average of what might happen in all situations and take a percentile from that distribution? But the key point, I think, that we get out of these calibration issues is coming back to Solvency II and the issue about the standard model versus internal models. So, as Seamus says, there are effectively some parameters that have been laid down in the standard model that specify the size of stresses that one would need to think about, and these have been called 99.5th percentile figures. Maybe it doesn't matter if that's what they're called, but they're laid down. But that's only works if you then have something comparable when it comes to an internal model where people are using their own calculations and thinking about these risks. Now, in this situation, many large insurers have effectively been told they're expected to have an internal model. That is demonstrating sophisticated risk management. But if you actually think about things carefully, then you're almost certainly can come to the view that a 99.5th percentile stress is significantly larger than the stresses that are in the standard model. And given that there's supposed to be an incentive to encourage internal models, that you'll end up with a lower capital figure, that's just not going to work with the current calibration that we have for the standard model. So just to summarise my views on this, I've obviously laid down sort of a number of issues. It clearly is the case that the capital adequacy standards are important. We can't walk away and say this problem's just too difficult and we're not going to do anything. We have to have a method for coming up with something which is going to be useful. But we do have to think very carefully about actually what the objectives for the standard are and what the implications of those objectives are. And I say regulators, in my view, do need to understand very carefully, understand exactly what the limitations of models are and the limitations of what people can do here. And they need to avoid creating perverse incentives, whether it's around choosing a standard model versus an internal model, whether it's around if the calibration of the different risks in the standard model is not consistent, they may be creating incentives for people to take certain types of risks rather than others in a way that doesn't really accord with the riskiness of those factors in practice. So I'm maybe not giving an actual conclusion here, but I do ask the question, is it the case that run-off approaches are actually better at meeting some of these objectives, better at reducing pro-cyclicality, avoiding extreme movements in capital requirements, and better at addressing the systemic risk issues? Perhaps simply because if you're doing a runoff calculation, different companies will be looking over different time periods. There isn't everybody looking at the same point and exactly the same reinforcing mechanism that goes on at present. So with that, I'll hand over to Malcolm.
Thank you. Okay. What I'd like to do is to move the debate, I guess, in a slightly different direction and look at the topic of value at risk versus tail value at risk, and in particular the underlying mindsets that exist or apply to those two different concepts. We just heard Colin talk about value at risk versus runoff, and in some sense, I agree it's not a sort of perfect sense, That is about a 1 year versus a longer time frame over which runoff might occur. With value at risk versus tail value at risk, it's a different dimension, and the key issue is what happens in the tail, hence the name tail value at risk. So what I'd like to do is just spend a few seconds explaining the difference between these two. Then I'm going to spend most of my time explaining what I think are the kind of intrinsic mindsets that you ought to be having if you agree with one or versus the other. And I'm going to express a view as to which one's more suitable for capital adequacy. And I'm also going to try and pick up on some implications that are relevant to insurance companies from following one mindset versus another. So if I just start off with the definition of, or at least how I've defined tail value at risk versus value at risk, this is essentially the same slide as Andrew showed earlier, except we've now got an additional line, which is the one slightly further to the left, marked average of worst 5%. So instead of looking at the cutoff at the point where there's 5% of the distribution to the left, we're now looking at the average loss that occurs in those 5 percentiles. Colin calls that the conditional tail expectation. It goes under a variety of names, so I hope you'll forgive me if I focus just on the title tail value at risk. More mathematically, you can express it in terms of integrals. And what I just wanted to highlight here is the difference in what's within the integral when you're calculating value at risk and tail value at risk. So with value at risk, you just take the probability that P of X. With tail value of risk, it's X times P of X. And essentially, my message in modern popular culture is tail value at risk has the X factor, whereas value at risk doesn't. And whilst that's clear from the mathematics, what I'm going to try and do is explain that it's also correct when looking at it from a more intrinsic perspective. Now, for those who are very mathematical amongst you, the reason that it's correct from this more intrinsic perspective can be derived from the mathematics, but it's not always easy to see that just at first sight. So, value at risk versus tail value at risk. Usually when people express arguments or frame arguments in favour of tail value at risk, they usually do so in a relatively mathematical language. And we are all familiar with some of those kinds of ideas, but it isn't necessarily, as Andrew's already alluded to, one that maybe all boards are familiar with. I'm not going to focus on this as an argument. I'm going to focus on the more intrinsic logic. But essentially, the arguments that are usually put forward for tail value at risk are around the idea of coherence, which is a relatively mathematical concept, but in essence, it's that tail value at risk behaves more sensibly in the way that we would expect risks to aggregate than value at risk. What I want to do, instead of focusing on that, is to focus on the underlying mindsets that you ought to have if you go for one versus the other. So consider a situation where we've got two different payoffs, you know, business opportunities, whatever it is, financial outcomes, and here it doesn't need to be related to capital adequacy at all. With the first payoff, we receive a sum M, if something occurs, and the only difference between that and the second payoff, payoff D, is that in the second one we receive 2M. Which is going to be more preferable? Well, unless you're particularly altruistic, I guess, you're going to prefer the one that gives you more money, which is... have I got this the wrong way round in this slide? I probably do, yes. Okay. It'll be D if... M is greater than zero, C if M is less than zero. And in essence, whenever you're looking at business propositions or trying to value assets or value liabilities or these kinds of things, you would typically include something within the computation that involves some probability of the event occurring and also the amount that occurs, in this context, a loss given default if we're trying to value a risky bond or a risky claim. So you've got two different components, which I've called PD and LGD, probability of default and loss given default. And the intrinsic difference between value at risk and tail value at risk is that the value at risk just focuses on the probability of default, whereas the tail value at risk also takes into account the loss given default. And I've tried to colour code those two so that you'll see it repeatedly occurring, which one's focusing on which. Certain bits, certainly markets care about loss given default. If you were worried about the price of a bond, you'd be very interested in the amount of recovery you might get if it defaulted. You wouldn't just assume that that was bound to be some arbitrary number that was constant across the entire universe of bonds. So markets do recognise that loss given default is important, and indeed some bits of regulatory capital computations and frameworks do also recognise that. And in essence, what I would like to ask is why don't we therefore try to apply it to the whole portfolio in some shape or form? And I do accept that tail value at risk may be more difficult to estimate accurately because it's more sensitive to what happens in the tail. But what I'm trying to highlight here is there's a difference in mindset. Which mindset is more appropriate? And the mindset, it seems to me, does depend a little bit on who you are when you're asking this question. And in particular, there is a difference between the mindset that shareholders might have versus essentially everybody else, the policyholders, the regulators, the FSCSs of this world. So shareholders, at least in a limited liability company, do have this thing called the solvency put option. So if the company goes bust, they can walk away from it. And limited liability is one of those enormously powerful inventions that mankind has come up with, and it's an important part of the way that business operates, and it's certainly something that shareholders do think about quite carefully. So I don't want to knock it at all. But the important point about it is that once you've lost the lot, you're not going to lose any more if you're the shareholder. So you don't really care very much about the loss given default. I mean, maybe the company could not quite completely blow the total, so you might get something back. But usually shareholders get very little if there's something that occurs in default. However, policyholders have a quite different perspective, and they do, or they at least one should expect that they ought to, be quite worried about the loss given default. And certainly when we had the sort of the bank runs and people standing outside wanting to get their money out, it was clear people were focused on what they were going to lose, and when the government changed the rules as to what they could expect to get in the event of a default, then the queues miraculously disappeared. So the customers, at least to banks, do seem to be pretty focused on loss given default. Actually, policyholders and customers of other sorts of financial services entities only care to a certain amount because they don't necessarily take the whole hit themselves. If the entity goes sufficiently belly up, then usually that loss given default gets passed on to other people, in particular to industry-wide protection schemes, or as we've seen, the government and the taxpayer and ourselves in that kind of context. So we ought logically to have a similar interest in loss given default. It's kind of beyond the point at which the policyholders have lost all that they are going to lose in the equation. So just to kind of summarise that in a visual chart, value at risk is great for shareholders. It matches their kind of characteristics in terms of loss given default, but tail value at risk is better as far as the policyholders are concerned and as far as the regulators and other sort of equivalent stakeholders are concerned. So the question is, why do we have capital? Do we have capital to benefit shareholders, or do we have capital to, you know, look after the interests of policyholders or conceivably these other external parties? And it does seem to me it's difficult to argue that capital adequacy isn't at least a little bit to do with policyholders and regulators. So it does seem to me that the VAR mindset is kind of intrinsically not the right answer in a capital adequacy calculation, whereas tail VAR does at least add back in this focus on the amount that you will lose in the event of default. That's the mindset kind of concept. I hope that's I've managed to prove to you that tail VAR has the X factor in that regard. I thought I'd also just try and draw out one or two implications of that so you can see that it isn't just a sort of theoretical argument that I'm attempting to sort of throw in your direction. So the first example I just want to focus on is how we might deal with illiquidity, which is topical for quite a lot of insurance companies because of the illiquidity that they might have, particularly in their annuity book. Then I also want to touch briefly on stress testing methodologies, and if we've got time I might get onto my usual hobby horse of market consistency, capital adequacy. So let's focus on treatment of liquidity first. Again, I just want to come up with an example, and hopefully this one doesn't have a typo in it. I've got two otherwise identical firms called A and B, and they both have a large line constituting the bulk of the firm's risk, maybe in ICA terms or whatever it is. And there they are identical, and they both have the same assets and the same liabilities. And I'm assuming that in that large line, they're not exposed to liquidity risk, at least not in any material way. So maybe it's a unit-linked block of business, and the funds are invested in highly liquid assets. So they've got this larger line where they're doing identical things, and they've got a smaller line where we will differentiate their behaviour, and one of them will do something different, and it is to do and it expresses some liquidity risk. So let's assume that they've got liabilities which are pretty illiquid in this smaller line, maybe an annuity book or whatever, and we're assuming that A and B both have this exactly the same liabilities, so they're still the same as far as that goes. But what we will use to differentiate them is we'll say that firm A invests in illiquid assets because it's bought into this idea that, yeah, it's illiquid liabilities, illiquid assets, it can match those two off. B instead has read the relevant chapter in my book and decided that maybe illiquid assets aren't quite so good a way to match illiquid liabilities, and decided to focus a little bit more on liquid assets. So the differential is in the amount of liquidity in the asset book of the two companies. And I want to pose the question, which of those two firms should you logically prefer if you're a policyholder, given that capital adequacy is all about policyholders and regulators and this kind of thing? Which, in other words, comes down to what credit should we allow when we're doing capital adequacy calculations for illiquidity that we might expect to be able to benefit from in the asset portfolio. And it seems to me, and I know this is, I've constructed this particularly to bring out this point, that the policyholders should prefer firm B, that's the one that is investing in liquid assets, rather than firm A, who invest in illiquid assets. And the important point of this is that therefore, some of the arguments that we might have in terms of liquidity premium, I think, are potentially a little suspect for taking too much credit for that within capital adequacy. Now, why do I think this? Well, it goes back to this probability default and loss given default. I chose the two firms so that the bulk of their risk was identical. It was in the larger line. And therefore, the likelihood of either of the two going bust is relatively similar. So the probability default is similar. Where there is a difference is in what happens if there is a default. So it's the loss given default. And if there is a default, what typically happens in default situations is that you switch from management being able to do all the sensible things that they would like to do, and it becomes a fire sale, and basically it all kind of goes wrong. And I would like to pose the question, which of the asset portfolios would you prefer to hold if you are in a fire sale? You have to sell it within the next week, 2 weeks, whatever it is that you're being forced to do as a result of having gone bust. And it does seem to me it's difficult not to come to the conclusion that the illiquid portfolio you're likely to get less for than the liquid one. So essentially what is happening here is that the illiquidity premium, you capture that if you invest in illiquid assets, but you pay for it in the event of default. And since capital is there to protect you against default, you ought to take into account what happens in default to your portfolios. So just to kind of summarise that, the logic of matching illiquid liabilities with illiquid assets is that the firm can actually hold a portfolio to maturity. That's the usual kind of arguments that's put forward. And what I'm highlighting is that what happens in default has got nothing to do with whether, well, it's related to whether the firm won't have been able to hold to maturity if it's gone bust in the meantime. And therefore, the loss given default is specifically different in these two examples. So value at risk will miss this subtlety, whereas tail value at risk, at least if properly implemented, shouldn't. Just another example, and this is something that I guess, again, has been focused on in the Turner review and in quite a lot of recent regulatory frameworks. There does seem to be quite a lot of additional focus coming through on stress testing. And that includes some of the kind of newer reverse stress testing, or some people call it tester destruction type stress testing. And there's liquidity stresses being built in that context as well. But it does seem to me that, again, most of these things focus on the sort of probability of default, so that they kind of say, you know, how bad does it need to become in order to suffer default? What I would again highlight is that it is therefore missing out, unless you kind of do a stress beyond destruction, to the what will happen in the tail. And I found an interesting kind of thought on this is that why do we hold capital? The FSA argues that a capital is held not just to cover going concern, but also a kind of gone concern situation. I think I use those words directly from a FSA paper. And that one of the reasons we have different tiers is to reflect the fact that capital does need to service, it has certain different characteristics depending on whether or not you're in a going concern or a gone concern situation. My own hobby horse, in terms of market consistent capital adequacy, I explained that you had this formula that involved probability of default and loss given default. Actually, when you do the sums, there's a further thing called the time value. And it's always been my view that maybe we should not use kind of real world probability distributions, but risk neutral probability distributions, because when we do these sums, that's how we do it in any other kind of context. But we can explore that further if you so wish. So just to kind of summarise what I've been trying to get at, value at risk versus tail value at risk, it does boil down to the difference between just probability default or probability default times loss given default. The mindset difference is this loss given default, the X factor, as I mentioned earlier, and the mindset difference at a very concrete level comes down to shareholders versus policyholders and regulators. And I've tried to highlight that there are situations where actually you get quite different answers, and it has big implications for how you ought to set capital adequacy, and in particular illiquidity is one, and maybe how we frame some of the newer stress testing approaches that seem to be coming more to the fore in current months. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Malcolm, and thanks to all our speakers. Now it's your chance to comment or question any of our speakers. I think the common feature of everything they've said is that none of them is expressing any great confidence in 99.5% VAR as a concept to underpin our financial regulatory frameworks. On the other hand, they've all been a little bit diffident as to perhaps what they might put in its place. So we have put on the screen some starter questions for 10 in terms of, I think as all the speakers said, you do have to think about what it is you're trying to do. Is there a mathematically tractable basis of determining capital adequacy for financial institutions, or is it essentially a confidence issue that if everyone believes institutions have enough capital, then they have enough capital, or is there some place in between those possibilities? What are the attributes of a risk measure, and how far does the Turner analysis, which he was careful to say was confined to the banking context, but how far might it stretch to the insurance context? And what should be the way forward? And at this point, I should plug our aspiration to set up a working party, which I know Andrew is part of, to take forward the discussion which will start tonight, because we feel these are issues to which actuaries have a contribution to make. And we hope that as many as possible of you will be interested in contributing to that work. But now over to you, questions and comments. Here in the front row...
John Spain, I think.
John Spain?
One question is provoked by your very last bullet point on that slide. What difference is there between actuaries and the actuarial profession?
Anyone can have a go at answering that, but the actuary profession is rich and varied in my experience. It's a rich and varied collection of actuaries. Con.
Collection of rich actuaries.
I'm not attempting to answer John's question. Two distinct areas, if I may. The first is expressly on value at risk. And firstly, I'll put in a plug because I'm doing one of these or a SIAS evening later this year on value at risk and modelling, which I think should interest most of the people here. The value at risk is not actually a risk measure. Okay? Never was, never will be. Value at risk is actually an exercise in comparative statics. There is no timeline there. And the whole point about risk, it's the irreversibility of time that enables risk to arise. Okay, and there is no time measure in value at risk. So it's not technically a risk measure or a dynamic measure at all. It's actually an exercise in comparative statics. Going back to where you are here, you shouldn't be asking questions about capital adequacy and how to measure capital adequacy. The questions that should be being asked here is, should we be regulating the institution? Or should we be regulating the function? Or should we be regulating the product? Because the moment you start doing that sort of thing, You move away from simply capital adequacy. You start thinking about product regulation. You start thinking about market regulation. For example, you might choose to limit the size of an individual risk written by a firm, and so on. There are a whole series. Should it be prescriptive? Should it be principle-based? I mean, principle-based is nice. It enables innovation. But innovation is nasty because innovation introduces Knightian uncertainty. And that gives you real problems because then you're no longer able to use traditional statistics because those are the statistics of closed systems, not open systems. And you have some real problems. I think you really have to go back and address the basic questions. To deliver a specific and third area comment or specific criticism, conditional tail expectations are nightmarish once you move into the extremities of distributions and the discrete form. And of course, practically what we have to worry about is discrete form. You're talking about kernel estimations in very small, very, very sparse numbers. It's not at all fun to do, Malcolm.
Yes, indeed, Mark.
As I say, the point that I was trying to get across is that there is a discontinuity between the shareholder perspective and the policyholder perspective. So if we believe capital adequacy is shareholder-focused, then we would go down the VAR route conceptually. If we believe it's policyholder-focused, then we should care about what happens in the event of default. And I do agree that this is not an easy thing to quantify. You're quite right that it's it poses challenges, but it's the underlying mindset that I was trying to get at, which is unless we remember that the money is there to protect policyholders, we're going to end up with the wrong answer.
Con, I was curious if you wanted to offer any answers to your own questions of what you think we should be doing in terms of regulating institutions, functions or products, or is it best we come along to your size meeting in due course? Okay. That's one to watch out for later in the year. More questions, comments? Martin.
Two points. The first one is maybe prompted by a comment just now, which is the shareholder focus. Shareholder focus was the approach used by banks. It gave a systematic collapse of banks. So I don't think it's sensible from the shareholder's perspective ever to think about taking advantage of the put option. but more generally, once you get too much precision and margins become visible, I think people tend to operate to the edge, just as the confidence created by derivatives caused financial institutions to gear up. So from a regulatory perspective, and this would be a very old-fashioned and perhaps unpopular point, I think the most effective margins to protect policyholders are implicit ones, because people's behaviour isn't influenced as if they exist. So that argues for implicit safety margins in all directions. And I know it's completely contrary to the thinking of the last few decades, but that's my view.
Thank you, Martin. Derek?
Thanks, sir. I have one comment and one question for the panel. The comment is on Malcolm's conclusion on the different perspectives, and I agree absolutely that shareholders and policyholders and regulators do have of different perspectives, but I don't think it's possible to generalise over which prefers which. One counterexample to Malcolm's conclusion is with profit funds. If you're just looking at the solvency of the with-profit fund and the chances of it burning through the assets, the the policyholders are only interested in the probability of default because they're going to get, beyond that point, they're just going to get 100% of their guaranteed benefits, whereas the shareholders are interested in the loss given default because they may well be forced to put more capital into the fund. Another counterexample is where regulators are only interested in having a point at which they can step in, intervene. If you know you're the regulator of a small country where all your insurers have large multinational parents, that you can always force to put more capital in, then you know the regulator's only interested in the probability of default. Question is, is there any rule of thumb for comparing tail VAR standards with VAR standards? In particular, the Swiss solvency test is very similar to Solvency II in a lot of respects. But it does differ in that the Swiss solvency test requires tail VAR at 99% over a one-year horizon compared with the 99.5% VAR. And so should actuaries be advising EU insurers all to move to Switzerland or Swiss insurers all to move to the EU?
Does anyone on the panel want to take...
I think I can answer that, actually. If I can go to back to the picture. My mouse is doing nothing. Can I reconnect the mouse, please? Sorry. Slide number... Is it working now? Got one more go before I say sod it again. Sod it. Sorry? Oh, the keyboard. Okay. Let's try that. Look at that, eh? Woo. There you go. So, let's suppose that instead of 5%, this was 1%. So you're looking at the worst 1% of it. And I have to say, this is an entirely hypothetical, theoretical discussion because you wouldn't know where the 1% was or the 5% or the 0.5% for that matter. But let's... put ourselves into the world of people who discuss these things, and you've got to look at the worst 1% of outcomes, then your T-bar will be based on the mean of those 1%, whereas your VAR at 99.5% will be based on the median. And I think you can see from this distribution that the median being left skewed, your mean is going to be to the left of the median, so T-bar at 99, I think is slightly harsher than VAR at 99.5. But all of this pales into insignificance compared to your inability to estimate either of them to any degree of accuracy.
Malcolm, you're getting views for and against mindset.
The disadvantage of coming up with a polemical set of slides. A very fair point about the with-profits. I guess what I was focusing on was the stage beyond the with-profits having kind of cashed out to the stage where the company is now running seriously short of money. So I agree that from the perspective of with-profit policyholders, what you've actually got is a kind of capital structure within the which you can kind of express the insurance company as, where there are different attachment and detachment points, to use terminology from structured credit, which I agree may not necessarily be the right thing to use in this at these current times, but where some of the losses get borne by some people, then other losses, you blow through that, get borne by another group of people, and then they get borne by further groups of people. And I guess my overall theme was think about what happens when you go through those different tierings, because it's not unimportant. It's related to the actual perspective that you've got. If you were
acting rationally, you would be very, very focused on what things would actually hit you and in what way they would hit you. So that was my what I was attempting to say.
Question at the back here.
We have already a lot of complexity. May I add one more piece? Because there's a lot of discussion around the too big to fail moral hazard aspect, which means shouldn't we also be asking the question, if an institute or institution contributes massively towards systematic risk or is particularly exposed to systematic risk, so how can that be captured in this concept? So i.e. should these institutions be additionally penalized with capital, but how do you measure this aspect? So is that something that is already part of your formulas, or is that something that would add to your formulas?
I mean, I think that's a very good question, and it's exactly the point that I was trying to make, in a sense, in saying I think we should be looking to regulate differently companies that effectively are taking different risks from other ones, where it's idiosyncratic risk. It's much easier to estimate or to make an allowance for the risk that they go insolvent. If it's systemic risk, it's clearly a much bigger issue, and potentially there are the sort of multiplier effects that go on, and therefore the capital should probably be significantly higher in order to discourage concentration of that type of risk. Exactly how you work out what is a systemic risk, is this the same sort of thing that everybody else is doing and therefore it should be treated more harshly? I think I'd leave that for the regulators to work out.
Of course, what we actually have in practice is the reverse, which is if lots of insurers get into the same hole, the goalposts are moved. So, equity market falls, everybody's looking at dampeners and not having such a strong stress test. If one insurer gets into a hole, then they're not going to have an exception made for them. So what we currently have is absolutely the reverse of what you're proposing.
Well, I think there's a more general point, which is to what extent do regulators, or to what extent should we be focusing on these kinds of systemic things? And this is partly a political question, but picking up on William's comment, it does seem to me that there's no fundamental reason why we should necessarily expect the same thing to happen with banks as we do with insurers, because they are operating in different markets. I agree that there's often a bit of fuzziness around the join, but conceptually the banks are... what they're offering is that when you put your pound in or your euro or whatever, you'll get that back.
The expression we're looking for is insurance companies
come. Well, yes, and also insurance companies do quite often have a lot of exposure to market risk. Is it the government's role to underwrite equity markets, whereas it might be the government's role to underwrite the monetary system? And I think the reaction that you've seen from governments around the world is that actually they do differentiate between different types of entities, and so we should expect regulatory frameworks and these kinds of things that you're talking about not necessarily to be identical between those two camps.
I'm a chairman of a small life mutual, and we find it hard to see the FSA taking quite the same interest in our intention to dispose or not to dispose of equities as it does in the case of Prudential, for example. More questions, comments from the panel?
Is that working? Yeah. I agree with a lot of what's been said in all of the three presentations, but I wonder how realistic it is, or sort of practical, I guess, and it all seems very theoretical to me, because, if you look at the fact that I think one of the first things Seamus said was it looks like the regulatory isn't going to move, so regulatory is done, you're then turning around to saying, well, what should you be doing as a company director on behalf of your shareholders. And if you look at what's happened to insurance stocks over the last few months, it's quite clear that, you know, the analysts, the shareholders, the market does not believe any of these numbers that are capital adequacy. And therefore, I still believe, and Andrew said it as well, that the numbers, it's going to be impossible to come up with a number that the market is going to believe. And having talked to a number of analysts, the only thing that they want to see is more of these reverse stress tests. I agree with the bit about the fact that there's a loss, there ought to be a loss given default in the reverse stress test, but I just wonder, I'd like to know what the panel think the use of any of the things that have been discussed tonight could be.
There's a challenge for us.
There was a paper discussed here on Monday about risk management and governance, and I think those two go hand in hand. And we've had plenty of situations where senior members of the board seemed not to know what was going on further down their organisation. And sometimes it's thought that the models were so complex that nobody could understand. And that's actually often not true. Very often people who are pricing CDOs all day long have a very good understanding of the weaknesses of their models. They realise that it's not in their career interests to try and raise the flag and shout at the board. They're most likely just get labelled as a troublemaker and fired. So I think a large amount of what we have is a governance problem. So when the shareholders mark down the prices, I think it's they're right, in a sense, to be sceptical about those numbers, because I don't believe that the boards have demonstrated their understanding of their own businesses. But that's not a technical thing about value at risk. That's more that the governance framework isn't quite working. You can have everybody doing their job properly. You can have the back testing with all the boxes ticked. You can have the model being signed off by internal and external audits. You can have you can tick all the governance codes, and the CRO has his wonderful Gantt chart and traffic light survey, and everybody tells him it's hunky-dory, so he believes it is. And all of those boxes have been ticked, and unfortunately they're necessary but not sufficient, because the world can suddenly change. And it's a real challenge to get the knowledge and understanding of that up to the board level, not to get it thrown back in the face of whoever raises the concern. It's even more of a challenge to get that disclosed to the shareholders. And the shareholders, I suspect, believe they're getting a sugar-coated version of what's actually going on. The board is sugar-coating it. The information has got sugar-coated before it reached the board in the first place. There's several layers of sugar-coating, and I suspect that's what we're seeing in the share prices.
A thought that I have is sort of triggered by, again, Turner's comments about the need for greater capital. And in particular, you know, he talked about the banks and the trading book versus the kind of more, quotes, conventional type banking. It does seem to me that part of capital adequacy is about, in some sense, being fair between different participants. So we can kind of different entities that are being regulated. So what we'd ideally want capital adequacy to do is not to put all of the extra capital requirements that Turner thinks is needed all onto one company, but we want it equitably shared across different companies. And so I think the a thought that I would leave in this kind of context is, how do we ensure that equivalent types of risk and equivalent kind of buckets of risk are kind of fairly allocated in terms of the total capital that we think the industry requires, so that one company isn't unfairly treated versus another. Quite how you do that within all the frameworks, I'm not sure that people necessarily know all the answers, but I do think we need to focus on the kind of equity between different firms, and that can be outside the context of a sort of pro-cyclical adjustment. So we might think that the total capital of the industry needs to be this amount at this point in the cycle, that amount at the next point, whatever. It's a question of how do we apportion those total capital requirements so we do have fairness across different participants in the marketplace.
I think it has to be said also that the fairness challenge is much greater when it comes to the softer elements of supervision. That you know, it's electorally unpopular for the regulator to close down UK PLC and hand it over to the French or the Germans. And people are kind of pretty aware of that. And so there was always a fear among European regulators that other regulators might be more lax than they are. And you might think that bringing in Solvency II and a common formula would solve that. But of course it doesn't, because suddenly we're hearing it's not all about the formula, it's about the governance and about the culture. So if you want the FSA to go around kicking French and Germans, then get them to focus on culture rather than formulas, which are more subjective and hard to check they're being fair. I'm sure British companies operating overseas are similarly concerned that their culture may be deemed lacking for their lack of lederhosen or garlic and snails. It makes it harder to be demonstrably fair when your criteria are much less subjective.
I think the original question was about reverse stress tests and their use by analysts. The issue I have around them really is the one of comparability, which I mentioned earlier. I think, you know, certainly there's useful information there, and it may be helpful to know that Company A will be insolvent if, let's say, interest rates fall by 200 basis points, and Company B if they fall by 150 basis points. Conversely, Company A will be insolvent if equities fall by 30% and Company B by 40%. Well, you know, that's useful information, but it would be useful to have some kind of a sense of the relative probabilities of those type of events, and therefore what that means for the overall riskiness of the two firms. So I agree, shareholders can make those kind of decisions for themselves, although for us to avoid giving any information on that, it seems to me is a bit of a cop-out. But I mean, at the end of the day, I do agree with you that actually the probabilities are impossible to assess. And coming back to the discussion on Monday night that Andrew referred to, on I think it comes back to risk management as being as an important consequence of all the sort of calculations that we're doing here. If we don't actually know the probability of something happening, then really one of the key questions we should be asking from a risk management perspective is what's plan B? What do we do if this does happen? As opposed to just saying, you know, that's game over.
Well, I pose the other. I pose a sort of knock-on question then, which is: suppose the total capital requirements of some block of business is 100 billion. How do I work out how much of that 100 billion I should, if I'm the regulator, I'll leave aside how they actually do it. But how as the regulator ought I to decide how much of that 100 billion should be with Company A or with Company B? You have to have some methodology which enables you to choose, you know, to kind of direct the industry and the firms in question to kind of apportion that total capital requirement somehow or other across different participants. Yeah, and what I'm saying is that there is a further question that we can pose, which is that the right way to do it? Yeah.
I think you could also separate slightly the formulas from the 99.5% VAR. If you look in, for example, Quiz 4, the latest version of what we have, what might be Solvency 2, you can argue about bits of it, but there are some things in there that definitely do make sense. It's riskier to be in equities than to be in property, and it's riskier to be in property than to be in cash. And just setting capital as 4% of liabilities didn't have that sensitivity, so it's a step forward. And perhaps that we could more easily live with the formula if we didn't have to go through the charade of pretending it was a 1 in 200 event, because there's actually quite a lot in the formula that makes sense.
Or telling people that they have to have an internal model instead, which has to be calibrated to 99.5th percentile.
I think I'd very much agree with that last point of Colin's, and I think it was reflected in the discussion in this hall just a few weeks back on internal models. The effort to calibrate those to 99.5% is likely to be counterproductive and potentially to introduce quite a lot of pro-cyclicality in internal models. Also in that discussion, there was, I think, particular discussion of the issues which present themselves in general insurance context in using internal models and the inappropriateness of the VAR, short horizon concept in in that context. Is that something maybe, Martin, you can enlarge on? We'll just get a mic to you.
We're not dragging this out, are we? the point I made at that meeting was that if you are a policyholder in a company that goes into runoff, you're limited to the amount of capital and margins, implicit and explicit, that are there to give you your promise. And if you take a one-year view, you have all the problems of VAR versus the rest of TVAR. If you take a two-year view, you're convoluting the two. And then the shape of the curve either side of the VAR point begins to matter. So that once you've convoluted it once, the likelihood of failure is way more than double, and it just explodes.
It's a very good point that in some sense capital adequacy does depend on your access to capital, and you know, the runoff is a classic example where you've got less access than you had, and quite how that ought to be incorporated in all of this discussion is again another interesting additional dimension that...
Start not from what capital have we got, but from what sort of promises do we think we should really be giving these policyholders, and do they understand the implications if you take a long tail policyholder and there's a bad accident in the market, you know, something hits an airplane, hits a big building, and you go into runoff, then in practice, you're not very likely to get, if you're really at the long end of that chain, you're not likely to get your policy paid in the end. Mm. And the regulators are quite likely to be pleasant to the company when times are looking good and allow them to take capital out.
Any final questions or comments from the floor? Okay, no. I think we may be in danger of heading towards the conclusion that rather in the same way that democracy is the worst form of government apart from all the others that have been tried, that 99.5% VAR may in fact be a serviceable approach to Solvency II. Although, of course, it may be capable of being improved upon. I think that is my own philosophy, although I do go through the odd existential crisis every morning. I think that perhaps the challenge for the profession is to make sure that the application of 99.5% VAR it does no more harm than is absolutely necessary. And this is a real issue because, unfortunately, the Solvency II legislation and indeed the FSA's rules tend to get interpreted by non-actuaries and people like lawyers, and it's in that interpretation that there is the potential to introduce pro-cyclicality and do harm, as perhaps Colin most underlined. I think we have had an interesting discussion where I'll compare notes with the speakers afterwards because their lack of confidence has not been wholly endorsed by the audience. But the points were about implicit margins is well made. That was a strength of actuarial approaches in the past, and perhaps recent events are suggesting that it's a strength we let go of too easily. The variety of optionality that can exist within insurance was a point which Derek made very well and does need to be taken on board. And I think there was agreement by all of the panel to the distinction reasonably to be drawn between institutions which are systemically important and the great majority of the rest. And I should, in that context, have welcomed the guest who made that point. Nicole Hergarten is representing the The ICFR, which is International Centre for Financial Regulation, set up to develop thinking in this subject in London. So I think there's been a lot of interesting food for thought, which I think we will try to take on board, and we have done our best to note the names of everyone who contributed, and hope that we may look for further interest in the working party, which we want to progress in the future. So again, I thank our speakers for providing context for a good discussion, and I thank particularly you, everyone who contributed, everyone who came, for the quality of the discussion we had. Thank you all very much.